Welcome to another episode of Behind the Evidence AODH, a podcast supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. I'm one of our co-hosts, Mark LaRochelle, an addiction-focused primary care physician at Boston Medical Center.
And I'm Honora Englander, an addiction medicine physician and health services researcher at Oregon Health and Science University. On Behind the Evidence, we seek to engage with recent practice-relevant literature related to substance use. The podcast draws from articles reviewed in the AODH newsletter and aims to understand what's behind the evidence through conversations, including with authors.
Excellent. Well, let's jump into today's episode.
Listeners, this is Honora Englander, and I'm delighted to be here today with you to present the next episode of our podcast. Typically, my co-host, Dr. Mark LaRochelle, and I conduct interviews together, but today it'll just be me conducting interviews, and Mark and I had a chance to co-plan this episode, and we'll be back as a team for our next round. What we've decided to do is base it off of the last episode that Mark independently did, where he interviewed a series of researchers and kind of gave you a potpourri of experiences. And today our episode is going to focus on a sample of recently published papers that have really important clinical practice implications. Hope you enjoy it. I'm delighted to be here today with Dr. Joe D'Aquino, Assistant Professor of Psychiatry at the Yale School of Medicine, who will be talking with us about his recent publication, The Impact of Cannabis on Non-Medical Opioid Use Among Individuals Receiving Pharmacotherapies for Opioid Use Disorder, a Systematic Review and Meta-Analysis of Longitudinal Studies. Dr. D'Aquino, thank you so much for being here with us today.
Thank you for having me. My pleasure.
I'm going to go ahead and jump right in with our first question, which is, tell me about why you did this study and what were you hoping to learn?
So the main research question of the study was to quantify the impact of cannabis use on the risk of returning to using opioids non-medically among people receiving medications for opioid use disorder. So these are people receiving methadone, buprenorphine, or naltrexone. And the reason why we decided to do the study is that the relationship between cannabis use and the risk of returning to using opioids non-medically during treatment remains unclear and has been a reason of a lot of debate. Some states have even authorized the use of opioid use disorder as a condition that qualifies for medicinal use of cannabis and its constituent cannabinoids. On the other hand, in parts of the United States, there are opioid treatment programs that will discontinue medication for opioid use disorder if patients test positive for cannabinoids. So we aim to look at this controversy and address this gap by systematically reviewing and conducting a meta-analysis of longitudinal studies to better understand this potential interaction.
One of the things that struck me when I was reviewing your paper in advance of our conversation, and you discussed this really nicely in the paper, is your choice to include longitudinal studies versus some of the other previous work that was less selective. Can you just talk to us a little bit about that?
Sure. Yes. So there were a couple of review papers that looked at cross-sectional data. We decided to look at longitudinal studies, meaning studies that track changes over time, because relapse is a longitudinal phenomenon, where, you know, returning to use substances non-medically is a longitudinal phenomenon. This is still an observational study, so it's hard to infer causal relationships, but to understand the impact of cannabis on non-medical opioid use, we believe it's important to assess the participants' opioid use status at baseline, and then over time, and combining data from multiple longitudinal studies increases the robustness of the findings. Cross-sectional data introduces biases and variations that might occur in individual studies. And so looking at longitudinal studies in a diverse sample of participants makes it more generalizable. And I think this is vital for making broader public health recommendations and clinical guidelines.
Tell us about what you found in your work.
So the main finding was that there's no significant association between cannabis use and non-medical opioid use among people receiving medications for OUD. The pooled odds ratio was around one, which did not indicate that cannabis use significantly influenced non-medical opioid use. And this was interesting because the results don't confirm concerns about cannabis increasing non-medical opioid use during treatment for opioid use disorder. And also, they didn't endorse the efficacy of cannabis in decreasing non-medical opioid use along with medications for opioid use disorder. And this was consistent, this result was consistent across various subgroups of types of pharmacotherapies. So we did do what we call sensitivity analyses, where we look at studies or people receiving only methadone or only buprenorphine or only naltrexone, and the results remained consistent.
Okay, interesting. Was that what you expected to find, or were your findings different than what you had expected?
I would, you know, from clinical experience over time, I would say that's not surprising. I would imagine some variability about the overall effect size to be somewhere in the middle. If you look at the forest plot, you know, the big diamond that summarizes the whole, it's right in the middle. And, you know, I think the biggest implication is for people treating people with opioid use disorder, you know, it really challenges the assumption that cannabis use might positively or negatively impact the effectiveness of medications for opioid use disorder. You know, given the absence of this association, there's no evidence to support, you know, these mandatory cannabis abstinence policies for maintaining the medication. And people should really, you know, have an individualized approach regarding cannabis use rather than enforcing a blanket abstinence policy. And what do I mean by personalized treatment? You know, a treatment that addresses the needs of each patient without necessarily prioritizing cannabis abstinence, unless it's clearly indicated, which it might be in some cases.
Say more about that.
So about one in three people who use cannabis, this is data from the general population, it will develop a problematic pattern of cannabis use called cannabis use disorder. And what that looks like might be, you know, when you stop using, you might get irritable, you have sleep disruption. So people say they have, for example, vivid dreams, which is an expansion of REM sleep because cannabis suppresses REM. So you have REM rebound, which is especially important for people with PTSD who have nightmares. People might find that they need to use more to have the same effect. So the same criteria that's applied to other substance use disorders is applied to cannabis. And we have a lot of products on the market nowadays that are very potent. The concentration of THC by dried weight in dried flower, herbal cannabis, has risen from around 4 to 7% in the 90s to around 12 to 17%. And that's street cannabis. You can buy a lot more potent products in dispensaries. And that's something that the study did not look at. A lot of these studies did not have, you know, granular data on what type of product people are using, the route of administration, the potency, the THC content, the content of other cannabinoids. So the bottom line is, you know, the zero tolerance policies need to be evaluated. And, you know, we need to recognize that cannabis is incredibly complex and there are lots of different cannabinoid products, right? And, you know, there's some mechanistic and clinical evidence that some cannabinoid isolates might actually be helpful. But we don't have, large scale clinical trials, 200 people or so. The type of clinical trials that the FDA considers to, pave the way for a new treatment. We might be there in a few years. So the other implication of this paper is we need more experimental research, not just with cannabis, but also cannabinoid isolates in this population. So individual cannabinoids, right? Like Delta 9 THC. We had a couple of studies in this area, cannabidiol, different combinations of these cannabinoids. There's other cannabinoids that are less well known, called minor cannabinoids. A few of them are CBG or CBN or tetrahydrocannabivarin, THCV. There are, close to 100 of them in the plant. And looking at the risk-benefit profile of them in this population is important because, at the state level, through a patchwork of legislation, the policies are way ahead of the science, so we're trying to catch up.
I want to loop back to something that you highlighted earlier that I think would be useful to have you expand on a little bit, which is an often widespread practice that I think your findings really push back on, which is that people are sort of under stricter controls or at worst even discharged from care with their methadone or buprenorphine in the US because of concurrent cannabis use. And I will just point our listeners to your discussion was really rich. And you also cite a paper that I am a big, I just think is an excellent paper by David Frank, which talks about really some of the enormous inconsistencies and problems with these very strict controls related to substance use that is not opioid related. And we can talk separately about other implications. But anyway, I'll hand it back to you, Dr. Diacchino, to speak about the implications from your paper.
Thank you. Yeah, that's I would say that's really the main implication. The need for policy changes, that reconsider the role of cannabis and cannabinoids in the context of opioid disorder recovery. A lot of these policies were not they were not generated from the bottom up. They were really top down. And now we have conversations about rescheduling cannabis. Really the main implication of this paper is if we want to practice evidence-based medicine, we need to ensure uninterrupted access to these life-saving medications for opioid use disorder while cautiously considering the potential role of cannabis. And right now we don't have evidence to say that occasional use of cannabis impedes recovery from opioid use disorder. We need to continue collecting data. This is an evolving situation. We have new cannabinoids in the market. However, we can't override the importance of preserving access to these medications, regardless of concurrent cannabis use. And I think at the end of the day, it's really about, promoting individualized treatment plans, harm reduction, and conducting further research on the role of cannabis and cannabinoid isolates in OUD recovery. I think if we implement these changes, we can, better support our patients on their path to recovery while remaining open to what they think the role of cannabis use is in their recovery so that they feel comfortable talking to us about it and ensuring that these life-saving medications reach everyone who need them, and which isn't, we know that that's not the case right now.
Thanks. I couldn't agree more. We're so far from where we need to be, and the stakes of discontinuing someone's methadone or buprenorphine because of non-abstinence, certainly from cannabis, based on your evidence, I would say the evidence is supporting that those harms are far greater than any potential benefits of that practice or policy decision. Thank you so much. Is there anything I haven't asked you about that you want to make sure to share with our listeners.
Well, thank you. Thank you again for having me. And what was the findings, you know, were consistent with my clinical experience, but what was surprising about this paper is the reception. It's a negative paper. And, you know, as I said, negative papers don't come with a bang. I think the reason this one was picked up by a lot of news outlets is that people do recognize the importance of these, the overlap between these two very important issues, one, the opioid crisis, the other, changing attitudes towards, and legislation toward, attitudes towards cannabinoids and a patchwork of legislation that regulates their use in the United States. You know, a lot of people know someone who has opioid disorder, and they know how important it is to have access to these life-saving treatments. One point that people confuse a lot is like, so this refutes the gateway hypothesis, right? So we get this question a lot, and this is not really addressing that question. This is addressing returning to use opioids during treatment for OUD. It's not about, you know, if you use cannabis, how likely are you to use opioids non-medically? You don't have OUD, or how likely are you to convert to opioid use disorder? That's a different line of research. I mean, there's some overlap, but this is about outcomes of OUD treatment. You know, I think this is especially important during, you know, where we live in a time where you have these very dangerous non-pharmaceutical opioids, fentanyl and its derivatives. And it's an evolving situation. You know, all the changes in attitudes and legislation towards cannabinoids kind of coincided with the opioid crisis. And, you know, we researchers often, the conclusion to every paper is more research is needed. But in this case, that is true. And again, we're talking about a plant with 140 chemicals and almost 100 different cannabinoids. And, you know, it has been controversial for a long time, right? I think our role as healthcare professionals and scientists is really to bring nuance to this discussion. And if the overall message can be, you know, let's prioritize evidence-based approaches and ensure that people ensure that the access to these medications is not interrupted while conducting cannabinoid research carefully, then I think the message of this paper will have the impact that we hope it will have.
Great. Thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
Delighted to be here today with Dr. Donovan Most, who is an associate professor in the Department of Psychiatry at the University of Michigan. Today, we're going to be talking about Dr. Most's paper that was published in JAMA Network Open, entitled Benzodiazepine Discontinuation and Mortality Among Patients Receiving Long-Term Benzodiazepine Therapy. Dr. Most, just to get us started, can you tell us why you did this study?
Sure. So I'm a geriatric psychiatrist, think a lot about prescribing benzodiazepines, in particular to older adults. There's been a lot of interest lately and concern around the amount of benzo use. And so I think a real push to sort of de-prescribe, discontinue benzodiazepine treatment. In some ways, I think we're sort of benzos are a few years behind where things are with opioids, in terms of like a lot of attention and focus on the problem. Oh, we need to sort of clamp down, cut down on long-term use. So the conventional wisdom would be like, oh, if there are risks associated with using these medications, then it must be better to get people off of them. And what we've seen with opioids is that may not actually be the case. Like there can actually be some risks for folks who are discontinued off of these medications. But there's really very, very little data out there to really actually look at whether there are risks related to discontinuation. So again, opioids, a few years ahead of us. There have been some papers in this space, including one by, I think, the podcast co-host that was specifically looking at opioid discontinuation. And so we decided we wanted to try and have a look at this related to chronic benzo prescribing.
I'm so glad you did the study. Tell us, what was your main research question?
So the question, very broadly, do there appear to possibly be harms when a long-term benzo, somebody who's prescribed long-term benzo use discontinues? We are limited. So you might think about harms in terms of like, oh, their insomnia gets worse or their anxiety gets worse. But in these types of sort of observational insurance data, they're just not sensitive enough to sort of pick up symptomatic return. And so we looked at a very crude outcome just of mortality was the primary outcome. And we used pretty strict criteria. So we set, if you look at people like prevalent benzo users, their use is all over the place. Like some people have a relatively low, you know, consistent but low rate of use of maybe a couple pills a week type of thing. We actually set a pretty stringent criteria for relatively constant and consistent level of benzo exposure to try to sort of even the playing field a little bit around who is this population that we were looking at.
So your primary outcome was death, and then you had a number of secondary outcomes that were looking at related harms.
Right. So things like so non-fatal overdose, suicide attempt or self-inflicted injury, suicidal ideation, or just emergency department use really for any reason.
And tell us just briefly, how did you go about answering your question? If you could just briefly describe your methods.
Yeah, I'm not an epidemiologist, but I'll try to explain this as best I can. So the trick with a study like this of looking at benzo discontinuation is to identify people who have discontinued or even have continued. They have to survive long enough to be able to include them in the study. And so if death is associated, say, with the discontinuation process, but they haven't stopped yet, you can't include them in your analysis if you sort of look at take people who look like they stopped and then look back in time, because they have to survive to the point where they've stopped to be able to look back in time. And so we used an approach called an emulated target trial, where basically you try and set up the data as if you were enrolling patients in a trial to discontinue benzo use. So you identify patients with long-term benzo use. So we said they had a year-long period of, I think it was more than 90% of days exposed, and they had to have an average daily dose that was essentially consistent over that entire year-long period. We excluded people that you wouldn't include in a benzo discontinuation trial. So things like cancer, where a benzo might be part of their palliative care regimen. Seizure disorder, where a benzo might be part of, if they have like treatment refractory seizure disorder, they need to be on a benzo. If they had recently had a non-fatal overdose attempt, because conceivably those are people who should be taken off, or you might argue they shouldn't be taken off. But either way, you sort of don't have, those are potentially people you wouldn't be randomizing in a clinical trial. So you sort of exclude people that you wouldn't want if you were really conducting this trial. And then you essentially have a period of time over which you observe them and say, have they discontinued or not? We define discontinuation if they had more than 30 days, may have been 31, but like about a month, if they went without a benzo prescription, we consider them to be discontinued. And we looked in a 6-month period of time, thinking like, that's a reasonable period of time over which somebody who's on chronic benzos might have their benzo discontinued. And if you look at actual randomized controlled trials looking at discontinuation, that's like a reasonable period of time. Actually, it's longer than most clinical trials looking at discontinuation use. So that's how you set it up in your data. And then you do this sort of complicated cloning process where if somebody during that 6-month period of time when you're looking to see whether or not they discontinued their benzo, you might have deaths during that period of time before they either have or have not discontinued their benzo. Like, it's too early to know whether or not they discontinued. And so you basically count them in both groups. You both count them in both the continue group and the discontinue group. Essentially, so you sort of don't like bias your results by an event happening before you could assign them to which treatment group they're in. I'll stop there, and hopefully that made sense to people.
That was great. And I will suggest to readers two things. One is, I thought that, Dr. Must, I thought that your description in the paper was very clear as somebody who is also not an epidemiologist. I learned a lot just from reading it. And I would be remiss not to mention to listeners that if you're interested in learning more about this, there was a really elegant paper published by Dr. Paul Christine and by my co-host, Dr. Mark LaRochelle in Addiction, about target trial emulation that came out just a couple of months ago. We'll put the link in the show notes.
And I'll also just say credit to Amy Bonner, who is the senior author on the paper, who is an epidemiologist, and then also the team of analysts I have working on this who helped me learn very much in the process of writing this paper.
Terrific, bravo. So moving on to, you know, you set up this trial with a really critical and important question using innovative methods that really can't be obtained from sort of typical controlled trials necessarily for a variety of reasons, including some of which you just mentioned. Tell us, what did you find?
Yeah, so we actually ended up finding that there was a slightly higher risk of all-cause mortality in the group that discontinued their benzos. So was that in absolute terms, the risk of death was 6.3% in the discontinuers versus 3.9% in the non-discontinuers. Specifically, so we stratified the analysis by whether or not they had been exposed to opioids or not. And so this was in the opioid, the group that had opioid exposure. So it was an absolute difference of a little bit over 2%, or a relative risk difference over the period of time of about 1.6 times higher in the discontinuation group. And the findings, not surprisingly, the opioid exposed group had slightly higher risk of death than the non-opioid exposed group. But the absolute difference in death between discontinuers and non-discontinuers, and that 1.6 times higher in the discontinuers than non-discontinuers, was basically similar for both the opioid-exposed and the non-opioid-exposed groups.
So overall, higher risk of death in people who had benzo discontinuation. Can you talk about some of the secondary outcomes as well? And either choose one or two, or just generally, what did that tell you?
Yeah, so I'd say overall, across all secondary outcomes, both in the opioid exposed and the non-opioid exposed groups, the risk of those outcomes was higher in the discontinuation group than it was in the continuation group. Again, sort of similar magnitude, slightly smaller, but I'd say that the pattern held really across all secondary outcomes.
Dr. Moss, tell us, what do you think are the biggest implications from your study?
So before I say implications, I'll say a couple of caveats. First is that we didn't look at, say, how quickly someone was discontinued off of their benzo. It's possible that some of these people were just like stopped cold turkey, which I really hope didn't happen, but it could have happened. Some people might have had a taper that happened over a like 2 week period of time. Some people might have had a taper that took like the first 5 months. And so it wasn't until the very end of that grace period, the 6 month grace period, that they were identified as a discontinuer. And so I'm part of a group developing guidelines around tapering long-term benzo treatment, and like very, very important point is around the pace and the rate of the taper. And I think anyone who's a clinician like understands the fact that how quickly this happens is a very important ingredient in how successful or not successful, or how distressing or not distressing, both from a psychological and a physiological perspective, coming off of chronic benzo treatment is. So I think those are very important caveats around interpreting the study. Do I think that this paper means that there are not harms associated with benzo prescribing? No, I really think that they're separate questions. I think we have a really big body of evidence that suggests that there are harms associated with, in particular, new benzo use. If you actually look at the data around, say, like fall-related injury, it's sort of like the risk seems most pronounced earliest in the course of treatment, which I kind of think makes sense. If you think about like using alcohol, if you've never drank before, the first maybe couple of drinks you have, the first period of time that you're drinking before you've developed any type of physiological dependence is when you feel the intoxicating effects in a more pronounced way. And so there are harms. I believe the evidence clearly shows there's harms associated with new use of benzos. And then we also know that there's this body of evidence in particular related to benzo and opioid co-prescribing where there are harms. However, that's not the same thing as somebody who's a consistent, persistent, chronic long-term benzo user whose brain and body have become accustomed to that chronic long-term benzo use. I think it's maybe a little bit too simplistic to think like, oh, we can just take the benzo away and all of those harms that were there when they started the prescription are just going to go away. And so I think more than anything, I hope that this maybe prompts some more research and some more careful research into really understanding, are there risks associated with stopping benzos among people who've been exposed for a long period of time? Because we just really actually don't have a ton of evidence to know whether risk goes up or goes down. And just the final limitation I'll say, since folks are hopefully listening, is, you know, we did this sort of fancy emulated target trial, but the truth is we still don't know, you know, the patients who had their benzo discontinued maybe because for some reason the clinician believed that they were at higher risk of mortality related to the benzo or not. Like they might have just been sicker patients who had their benzo stopped. And we ultimately can't account for that in this study. So more than anything, I think it's just a like, hey, let's pay attention to this. Let's not recreate the mistakes that have maybe one might say have happened related to opioid deprescribing.
Thanks. I think your points are all so important. And I also think that particularly just want to reflect on what you say, which is that the context within which all the medications that we prescribe, be it opioid agonist therapy or benzodiazepines or opioids for pain, that context has such important implications, whether or not it's in a harm reduction framework, whether or not it's in sort of et cetera, but the intent has such powerful implications and the potential, both on the potential benefits and on the potential harms. And I sort of hear you saying that your discussion of the findings here.
Yeah, I think more than anything, I would hope that I don't necessarily think the default assumption should be that everyone who's on long-term benzo treatment should be discontinued. Mm-hmm. I think clinicians can feel a lot of pressure on this topic. When I talk to groups of psychiatrists, they can be very defensive because they see in particular, say for treatment-resistant anxiety disorders, that benzos have a really important role in treatment. And so it's like part of, I think, any part of medicine where there's like maybe some overprescribing, I would argue probably the magnitude of overprescribing is bigger. Like we know that there's just like a lot of prescribing that's not necessarily for an anxiety disorder or who knows why they got started on it a long time ago. So I think on a population basis overall, there's probably too much prescribing. However, there are definitely some patients for whom this is an appropriate treatment and they've tried other things that haven't worked and they're working with a clinician who really knows what they're doing and is really being thoughtful with them around the risks and harms for this individual patient. And so we just want to make sure that there still is room where benzo treatment is appropriate. And let's not have the default be like, oh, it's safer for everyone if we take them off of these medications.
Sure. Yep. Right. And that overprescribing and deprescribing are very different, just as you said, very different concepts, really. And so they may not have the same solutions.
Right. Yeah.
You pointed out one thing that I also wanted to ask you to speak about in the paper, which is when you think about the findings as it relates to some of the earlier clinical trials and just patient selection and who, I really liked your choice of study design for this research question, because as you said in the paper, people who enroll in a clinical trial around benzodiazepine deprescribing are going to be very different than the general population, perhaps. So could you just talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think that's just been, that's so such a challenge in this space, again, probably quite similar to opioids, where the individuals who are willing to participate in a study where the goal of it is potentially to stop their benzo can be a really hard sell for people. And so we did some work in the VA where they had sort of a national program to promote, you know, appropriate psychotropic prescribing, and facilities could kind of pick what they wanted to focus on. It's called the Psychotropic Drug Safety Initiative. And so about a third of facilities focused on benzo prescribing to older veterans, where again, like there might be some people for whom benzo prescribing is appropriate, but for, you know, patients in their upper 60s and 70s, it really is like, I'd say a select population where it's appropriate. And so the way I ended up getting like an R01 equivalent in the VA to do a mixed method study looking at this program and what strategies facilities use to address benzo prescribing. And part of the way that I advocated for it was that if you look at the Empower intervention, which is this wonderful direct-to-patient education intervention done by a group of geriatricians in Canada, showed great effects, kind of hard to believe effects, from just like sending patients information in the mail. The number of patients who ended up discontinuing their benzo on the basis of this really light touch intervention was remarkable. But if you look at the consort sort of diagram of all the patients who were identified, who were eligible for the study, down through the number of patients who actually like received the intervention, I think it was like 5% of the eligible population for the study. So again, clearly it's an effective intervention for a tiny fraction of the population. And, you know, it's worth doing because it's just mailing them some information, but it really, it's hard to say that it generalizes sort of to the broader universe of folks who are on chronic treatment for these medications. And so there are some important trials looking at benzo discontinuation, but they're relatively few. And if you really look at the population that actually consents to participate, I think there's some challenges in generalizing to the broader population.
Dr. Must, thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today. We're really delighted to learn about your excellent work, and thanks for moving this really understudied and critically important area forward. And thanks for sharing it with our team and our listeners.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
Behind the Evidence is hosted by Anora Englander and Mark LaRochelle. Production by Raquel Silveira. Editing by Casey Calver. Music and cover art by Mary Tomanovich. Miriam Kumarami is the medical director of the Graykin Center for Addiction and co-editor-in-chief of AOD Health, together with David Filene. Learn more about AOD Health and subscribe for free at www.aodhealth.org. Behind the Evidence is supported by the Graykin Center for Addiction at Boston Medical Center. It is intended for educational purposes only and should not be considered medical advice. The views expressed here are our own and do not necessarily reflect those of our employers or the authors of the articles we review. all patient information has been modified to protect their identities.